From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Security, Medicare, Medicaid, schools, these all have very serious defects. They're based on a principle that is evil, as George Bush hears from his direct line to God.
Today, we play the speech of renowned author, critic, linguistics professor Noam Chomsky, speaking at the University of District of Columbia just yesterday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of people are protesting over the weekend against the Group of Eight industrial nations meeting in Evian, France. But authorities have completely cordoned off the small spa resort town from protesters with a 10-mile ring of steel backed by 25,000 police and troops. Yesterday, over 75,000 people marched peacefully to the French-Swiss border. Police severely injured a 39-year-old British protester Martin Shaw when they cut the rope he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. Shaw dropped from the motorway bridge, suffering multiple fractures. British news photographer Dan Smallman of Images Sans Frontières also suffered serious muscle damage to his leg after a stun grenade exploded near him. He underwent 2 hours of surgery and will have to undergo skin grafts. Protesters blocked traffic by erecting barricades on bridges in Geneva and highways in both France and Switzerland. But according to the Associated Press, most of the leaders landed at Geneva Airport and traveled to Evian by helicopter. The AP reports tension flared when the demonstrators tried to return to Geneva and were confronted by rows of riot police. Police fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon, and German police brought in to help led mounted baton charges on protesters. A small group of protesters threw Molotov cocktails and stones at police. Police also raided the building some protesters were using as their headquarters. Independent media journalists report police were dressed in anarchist black bloc gear. The AP reports protesters looted gas stations and shops and smashed the bulletproof windows of large banks. The organizers of the Evian protests were quick to distance themselves from the violence. Dozens of people have been arrested. Meanwhile, on the other side of the steel fence, President Bush and French President Jacques Chirac met today for the first time since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Bush is trying to win French support for an action plan on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. The London Guardian reports Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are desperate for a convincing show of unity after their diplomatic fallout with Russia, France, Germany over Iraq. But President Chirac is resisting Washington's call for sweeping powers to allow ships to be intercepted on suspicion that they're carrying weapons for terrorists. This news from the United States. Eric Rudolph was arrested on Saturday after one of the largest manhunts in history. Rudolph has been charged in an attack on two abortion clinics. One of those attacks killed a police officer as well as critically wounded a nurse. The bombing of the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta as well that killed two people and an attack on a gay nightclub in Atlanta. Rudolph spent part of his youth living with the Army of God and with Christian Identity, the white supremacist religion that's anti-gay, anti-Semitic, anti-foreigner. For years, the survivalist and Army veteran hid deep in the forests of Appalachia from police equipped with bloodhounds, infrared-equipped helicopters, and motion detectors. He received support, it is believed, possibly from local people in the community. They sold T-shirts saying, "Run, Rudolph, run," and slipped pictures of dead fetuses on the cars of FBI and media joining the chase. Eric Rudolph was arrested on Saturday rooting through garbage bins in Murphy, North Carolina, by a rookie police officer. But Attorney General John Ashcroft seemed to take credit for the arrest, saying, quote, "The most notorious American fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list has been captured and will face American justice." He said the American people, most importantly, the victims of these terrorist attacks, can rest easier. This news from Zimbabwe. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai was arrested today, the first day in a week of protests and strikes called by Tsvangirai's party, the Movement for Democratic Change. The MDC calls this week protests the final push in the attempt to drive Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe from power. The capital city of Harare is almost entirely shut down by a massive strike. Police fired tear gas to disperse protesters. Tanks have moved into Harare's townships. The High Court handed the government a victory over the weekend, ruling the protests illegal. State television proclaimed the protests and strikes will be, quote, met with the full wrath of the law. Nearly 3 out of every 4 Zimbabweans are unemployed. The inflation rate is over 250%. Electricity and water are intermittent. Food is short, and a famine is approaching. The Burmese government arrested opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi on Friday, as well as 19 officials from her party, the National League for Democracy. The government also locked down her headquarters, other party offices around the country, and closed universities in an attempt to prevent students from protesting. The actions come after her supporters and a pro-government group fought in the north of the country. 4 people were killed. Australia, Britain, France, and Sweden have demanded that Aung San Suu Kyi be released immediately. Secretary of State General Colin Powell was so disturbed by questionable intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction that he assembled a secret team to review the information he was given before he made a crucial speech to the UN Security Council on February 5th. This according to the current issue of the U.S. News and World Report. According to the news magazine, Powell's team removed dozens of pages of alleged evidence about Iraq's banned weapons and ties to terrorists from a draft of his speech. At one point, he became so angry at the lack of adequate sourcing of intelligence claims that he swore, "I'm not reading this. This is bull." On Friday, CIA Director George Tenet was forced to issue a statement denying the agency had doctored intelligence reports. And U.S. occupation forces in Iraq have abandoned plans to hold a national congress to select an interim government. Instead, the U.S. will appoint a council of some 30 senior figures who will shadow the U.S. administration to prepare for taking power. According to the London Telegraph, the council will be in place within 6 weeks. Meanwhile, U.S. forces have dropped their attempt to cleanse Iraq of assault rifles. Citizens will now be allowed to keep their AK-47s. The U.S. issued no explanation for the change. According to the Telegraph, residents were invited either to register their weapons or to hand over to the police the thousands of machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades that have flooded the city streets since the war ended. But police stations across the city reported that not a single weapon had been handed in on the first day of the amnesty. Steve Earle, Jerusalem, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, as we just got word that among those that were arrested was Jackie Suen, who has been working with Democracy Now! While in Iraq with Jeremy Scahill for quite a time. The word is that she was beaten by police, had a tooth knocked out, and was arrested as she was covering what was taking place in Evian, the protests against globalization and the G8, the industrialized countries that are meeting there. We're going to turn now to Noam Chomsky, who gave a major address yesterday at the University of the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. 2,000 people packed into the gymnasium to hear the professor of linguistics and one of the leading dissident voices in this country speak about the politics in the Middle East, the invasion of Iraq, and much more. This is Professor Noam Chomsky.
Well, let me start with last fall, last September, fall 2002. That was September was a very important moment in world affairs and world history, in fact. Last September, the most powerful state in history declared its intention to maintain its domination of the world by force, the dimension in which it does reign supreme. And it made it clear that it would use this force not only to control the world, but to destroy any potential challenge that it sensed to trying to equal oppose this force. There wasn't any mistaking the intended message. It was clear, frank, honest, and it was understood right in the heart of the establishment, in fact. So the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, in its next issue had an article by a well-known international relations specialist, John Eikenberry, who described it in words so clear and accurate that I'll just quote him instead of giving my own. He said that the United States had announced a grand strategy that begins with a fundamental commitment to maintaining a unipolar world in which the United States has no peer competitor, a condition that is to be permanent so that no state or coalition will ever challenge the United States as global leader, protector, and enforcer. The position renders international norms of self-defense enshrined by Article 51 of the UN Charter almost meaningless. In general, the stance dismisses international law and institutions as of little value, he says. If you read the document as you should, you'll notice that there's barely a mention of either the United Nations or international law. Going on with Eikenberry, the new imperial grand strategy presents the United States as a revisionist state seeking to parlay its momentary advantages into a world order in which it runs the show. It will prompt others to find ways to work around, undermine, contain, and retaliate against U.S. power. The strategy may appear successful in the short term, but, he goes on, it threatens to leave the world more dangerous and divided and the United States less secure. It's a view which is, in fact, widely shared right within the foreign policy elite, not to speak of overseas, where George Bush has indeed succeeded in granting Osama bin Laden a wish beyond his wildest dreams, I imagine. He's turned the United States into the most feared and disliked and in many quarters hated country in the world. The rhetorical radicalism of this imperial grand strategy is highlighted when you contrast it with the conception of world order that's sustained by the International Court of Justice, the World Court, that was reiterated shortly before the strategy was announced by its president, who happens to be a U.S. judge, conservative U.S. judge, Schwebel. He's long been a defender of lone defender of U.S. policies at the court. He was presenting the annual ICJ report to the United Nations. He informed the General Assembly that as the court enters the first century of the third millennium, it stands for international law, not international lawlessness, for the peaceful settlement of international disputes in conformity with international law, not the will of the more powerful party, for international organization, not for international anarchy, nor for a state sovereignty which purports to be above the law. It stands for human rights, rights that can be effectively realized only within functioning systems of law, local, national, and international, exactly what is to be torn apart by the imperial grand strategy. Hard to find a more dramatic antithesis than this statement by a conservative U.S. justice and the administration of his country. And it sent plenty of shudders around the world, including, as I mentioned, U.S. foreign policy elites. If you read about it, it's often called a new doctrine of preemptive war. That's not really accurate. The term preemptive war actually has a meaning. Preemptive war means which could fall within the range of Article 51 of the UN Charter. That's the article which grants the unique right of use of force in self-defense against armed attack. Preemptive war would be a war against ongoing or imminent attack when no other means are available. So, for example, you may recall that 20 years ago, another cowboy leader over in the White House warned us that we were about to be attacked from an air base in the dangerous state of Grenada, where the Russians were going to use it to, assuming they could find it on a map, they were going to use the air base to bomb us. Okay, suppose that fantasy was real. It led to a U.S. invasion, after which the U.S. was standing tall once again for saving us from this threat. But suppose it were true and, you know, the Russians were bombing us from Grenada and the planes were in the air and they were plainly heading to Washington to bomb the White House, then it would be legitimate under the doctrine of preemptive war for the U.S. Air Force to shoot them down before they actually did the bombing and maybe even to attack the air base in Grenada. That would be preemptive war. But that's not what's proposed. What's proposed is sometimes more accurately called preventive war. So in the technical literature, it's pointed out, preventive, not preemptive, means you're going to prevent any potential challenge. However, even that is much too generous. There's nothing to be prevented. So the invasion of Iraq wasn't intended to prevent anything. And the doctrine makes clear that what's going to be prevented is any challenge that the U.S. government decides is a potential challenge. Well, that's a doctrine of prevention which calls for Nuremberg trials. At the outset, the explanation was that preventive war would be against any country that's threatening to develop weapons of mass destruction, which could ultimately threaten us. After the fiasco about finding weapons of mass destruction, that was modified, and the latest version that's been pronounced by a high official is that the U.S. is entitled to carry out preventive war against any country that has the ability and intent to produce weapons of mass destruction. Well, just about anybody has the ability, including the local high school here, if it has a chemistry and biology lab. And intent is, you decide when there's an intent. So that essentially means we'll attack anybody we like. We decide they have the intent, they always have the ability, so it's fair game. The imperial grand strategy that was announced is a doctrine. When you announce a doctrine, you have to get people to take it seriously. It has to be converted into what respected it's okay if I criticize lawyers, yeah, what respected legal commentators will call a new norm in international affairs. And in order to establish a new norm in international affairs, the doctrine has to be implemented. So therefore, Washington needed a test case to implement the new doctrine and establish it as a norm, what the New York Times, after the event, called a Petri dish test case, where you try it out and make people know that you mean it seriously. The target for preventive war has to meet a number of conditions. First crucial condition, and this is worth keeping in mind for predicting the future of the doctrine, the first crucial condition it has to meet is that the country has to be completely defenseless, kind of like Grenada, that otherwise it's not a good idea to get involved in a conflict. That requires a huge propaganda campaign, like in the case of Grenada, to build it up as an awesome threat, but then you miraculously succeed in overcoming it. But you have to understand that it's defenseless. The second crucial condition it has to meet is that the country has to be important enough to be worth conquering. So there's no point to conquering some country in Africa that nobody ever heard of. The third condition is that it has to be evil. So when you put together the three conditions, defenseless, important, evil, that spells Iraq. The first two conditions are obvious. It's obviously defenseless, it's enormously important, right in the heart of the world's energy-producing regions, second largest resources in the world. As to the evil, that's easy too. You just have to repeat the standard Bush and Blair and Powell rhetoric, which is all accurate except hypocritical. You have to repeat the mock horror about a man who's so evil that he would even use gas against his own people. Heard this hundreds of times, always omitting the crucial words, with our help, because we didn't care. You also have to express more mock horror about the, in fact, horrible mass graves that are being exposed every day from Saddam's vicious repression of the 1991 uprising that might well have overthrown him, again omitting the crucial words, with our help, for reasons that were in fact clearly explained right in the mainstream press. So when the U.S. turned down requests from rebelling Iraqi generals to have access to captured Iraqi equipment and authorized Saddam Hussein to use the military helicopters and other heavy weapons that were, of which you can now see the effects. It was known then, but now it's graphically explained. It was explained in the press. This, we didn't like it, but it had to be done for higher reasons of state, to maintain what was called stability. The chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, essentially giving the State Department position, explained that we just had to do it. He said the best of all worlds for Washington would be an iron-fisted military junta ruling Iraq the same way that Saddam did, but with a different name, because his name was now embarrassing. We supported him all along, but can't do any more, so we need another Iraqi military junta, but somebody else. And since we haven't been able to find anyone else, we'll settle for Saddam Hussein, second best, but definitely not leave Iraq in the hands of its own people, which would have been the very likely outcome of the uprisings had the United States, which is of course in total control of the air and the ground at the time, if it hadn't essentially authorized the slaughters whose effects, grisly effects, are now being deplored. Well, that worked, but there is a guiding principle that remains. If you take a look at all the meandering of U.S. policy with regard to Iraq over the last years, there is one fixed principle. Iraq cannot be ruled by its own people.
Noam Chomsky, addressing 2,000 people at the University of the District of Columbia on Sunday in Washington, D.C. We'll be back with that address in a minute.
The sun is setting on the century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about. Confuse liberty with weaponry and watch your kids act it out. And every year now, like Christmas, some boy gets the milk-fed suburban blues, reaches for the available arsenal and song.
Ani DeFranco singing to the teeth here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to MIT linguist and leading dissident Noam Chomsky, speaking in Washington, D.C.
2 days ago, a leading Shiite cleric who was speaking to a huge crowd in the what's now been renamed the Sadr City slum in Baghdad, appealed to what he called people of humanity in the United States to oppose the U.S. military occupation and leave Iraq to its own people. And again, with all the meandering of policy, that principle has remained. Rejection of that option remains a constant, invariant principle. And it follows from the second of the three conditions. Iraq is just too important to be left to its own people. We've got to run it. Well, in any event, Iraq met all three conditions. The new norm of preventive war is therefore established. Legal scholars can now explain learnedly that law is a flexible living instrument with norms established by practice and so on. Again, there's a few words omitted. The norms are established by the practice of the most powerful state, nobody else. If others commit what was called at Nuremberg the supreme crime, namely the one that was just reenacted in Iraq, if others carry that out, or even lesser crimes, they don't establish new norms. In fact, they have to be severely punished. But when the most powerful state does it, that's a new norm, got a precedent, doctrine's fixed. Okay, back to September. One crucial event in September was the pronouncement of the new doctrine, and the second was the beginning of the massive propaganda effort to build up some degree of popular support for the planned implementation of the doctrine, the Petri dish. That's September's when the drumbeat of propaganda began about how Iraq was an imminent threat to U.S. national security. There were also insinuations about Iraq's responsibility for 9/11, about its links with al-Qaeda, its man's a terrorist, and so on. And that had a very quick effect. Within a few weeks, Congress passed a resolution granting the executive the right to use force at the White House's choice. Because of the threat to the national security of the United States. Those of you who, with a good memory, may recall that in 1985, the previous cowboy leader declared a state of national emergency in the United States because of the threat to the national security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua. That was after the threat from Grenada had been, thankfully, beaten back. But the Nicaraguans were only 2 days driving time from Harlingen, Texas. They're waving their copies of Mein Kampf, as Secretary of State George Shultz put it, just about to destroy us, but as Reagan courageously announced, despite the odds, he's not going to be afraid. He's going to continue fighting, recalling Winston Churchill, which you're supposed to do in those circumstances. And we had a state of national emergency redeclared annually and redeclared again by Congress last October, this time with regard to Iraq, not Nicaragua. That had an instant effect. There was a huge government media propaganda campaign. By the end of September, polls registered that about 60% of the population thought that Iraq was an imminent threat to the security of the United States. Similar percentages quickly came to believe that Iraq was involved in, maybe even responsible for, the September 11th bomb attacks. And that it was linked to terror and the planning new ones and so on. That those opinions were, as you'd expect, closely correlated with support for war. And that makes a lot of sense, you know, if you believe that Iraq is a major threat to, an imminent threat to our security, that it carried out the September 11th bombings, planning new ones. Yeah, then it makes sense to prevent the next attack before it's too late. So correlation is not surprising. There was the carefully stage-managed speech, victory speech on the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier, was announced, Bush announced a victory over terror because of Iraq's links to al-Qaeda. All of this is known to be complete fabrication, but it's quite effective. He could make that speech without fear that the headlines were going to say you're lying, and you know perfectly well there's no connection to al-Qaeda. Senior, one well-known commentator, senior associate of the Carnegie Foundation, Anatole Levin, describes this government media propaganda campaign. He says, for systematic mendacity, it has few parallels in peacetime democracies. And that's not entirely false, though. If you go back to the first tenure in office of the same people, it's mostly recycled Reaganites. There are plenty of similar examples, and unfortunately plenty in between, too. It was effective. The U.S. is unique in the world in having regarded Iraq as a threat to its security. Saddam Hussein was despised everywhere, quite rightly, but not feared. The countries of the region, which had every reason to fear him, didn't fear him. In fact, they'd been working for a number of years to try to reintegrate Iraq back into the regional system and maybe hope for some internal overthrow, which could have happened. Kuwait and Iran, two countries which Saddam Hussein invaded, they, of course, despise him, but they didn't fear him. And they didn't fear him for perfectly obvious reasons, perfectly well known to U.S. intelligence. Iraq was the weakest state in the region by a long shot. Its economy and its military expenditures were about a third those of Kuwait, which has 10% of its population, much less than other regional countries, far below the regional superpower, the U.S. offshore military base in Israel, which completely dominates the region militarily. But even next to the neighbors, it was essentially nothing. It's the condition, first condition for the Petri dish. There was a relationship to al-Qaeda. The relation is that recruitment for al-Qaeda and similar networks shot up during the build-up to the war, and since then, exactly as had been predicted by intelligence agencies and independent strategic analysts, and for very obvious reasons. It's been understood that measures like this and threats like this will lead to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and terror, if only partly for revenge, but if only for deterrence. That's well understood. Well, another event last September, critical event, was that September was the opening of the midterm election campaign. The most important person in Washington, Karl Rove, Republican campaign manager, had explained to Republican activists over the summer, in fact, that they had better make sure not to go into the election campaign allowing domestic issues to have any prominence, because they'll get smashed on that for obvious reasons. They have to switch the focus of the campaign to national security. That way, maybe people will, you know, hide under the umbrella of power and forget the fact that they don't have a pension, and Kenneth Lay is walking away with their money, and so on and so forth. And that was done. For the next presidential campaign coming up, Rove has already stated the obvious. It's nice that he says it. You can quote him. It's obvious even if he doesn't say it. Namely, that they're going to have to do the same thing for the presidential campaign for even more striking reasons. The Wall Street Journal correctly pointed out that the extravaganza on the Abraham Lincoln was the opening shot in the presidential campaign. It wasn't a victory speech. There's no victory, but it was the presentation of the powerful wartime leader who will protect us from the next dragon he'll be about to slay by then. The campaign, just by sheer accident, is beginning in New York City on September 11th. Delayed to have the right date, and the core issue will be defending us from an imminent threat to existence. Crucially, don't pay any attention to that $44 trillion deficit that was calculated by government economists, but kept out of the federal budget message to Congress a couple months ago, so as to expedite passage of another tax cut for the rich. The purpose, as a number of mainstream top economists have pointed out, and is obvious again, is to yield what they call a fiscal train wreck, the purpose of which is to destroy social spending. So you can't go into an election saying we're going to wipe out any social spending, you know, that might help people, but you can say we've got a fiscal disaster, so therefore what can we do? You know, you've got to destroy everything. In fact, it was conceded by White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer a couple days ago in a press conference here. He was asked about the $44 trillion deficit, and he said, yeah, it's accurate. There is no question that Social Security and Medicare are going to present future generations with a crushing debt burden unless policymakers work seriously to reform those programs. Well, reform doesn't mean fund them with progressive taxation. What it means is dismantle them by various devious means. One is to transfer them over to the states, which have a crushing fiscal burden as well. And all of this is really important. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, schools, these all have very serious defects. They're based on a principle that is evil, as George Bush hears from his direct line to God. They're based on the principle. They're based on the principle of sympathy, the principle that Adam Smith and David Hume and other dangerous radicals described as the core of human nature. And that's correct. All of these institutions are based on the idea that you should care if the disabled widow across town can survive another day, or if the kid across the street can get a decent education. And that's evil. You're not supposed to believe that. Evil doctrines have to be driven from the mind, as Ashcroft and Bennett and other moral authorities can explain. That means you got to eliminate the institutions. If you can only do it by a fiscal train wreck, do it that way. Actually, there are other advantages. many others. But one is that, say, privatization of Social Security, so say privatization of pensions, that has the great positive element of compelling working people to be actively committed day by day against their own interests. So if your pension depends on the profits of the company you're working for or whoever else you've invested in stocks, you must oppose decent wages, safety standards in the workplace, labor rights. You got to oppose all those things because otherwise you won't have a pension. You have to make sure that the rich are happy, because if they're happy, maybe they'll be nice to you, just as in the feudal system, which they're effectively trying to restore. A number of commentators have pointed out that the focus on national security and Iraq and all this business was done for short-term political advantage. But that understates the point. This is very serious. Maintaining a very thin hold on power is a very high priority. A couple more years in power, they may be able to institutionalize the extremely regressive programs that will seriously undermine human rights, civil liberties, create a kind of utopia of the masters. And the only way to maintain that thin hold on power is to inspire fear, exactly as Karl Rove explained. And worth bearing in mind that all of this is second nature to the people in office right now, mostly recycled from the Reagan-Bush administration, in fact, from its most reactionary component. During the Reagan years, the policies that the government was carrying out were quite unpopular domestically, which isn't surprising. There was a period of relatively slow growth, but also of stagnation or decline for much of the population. The U.S. ended up that period with the highest workload in the world and the lowest wages. That was a welcome development of transcendent importance, the Wall Street Journal editorial said, but the population didn't quite agree with that. In 1984, which is called a Reagan landslide, meant about 30% of the electorate, of the voters by a considerable majority, about 3-2, hoped that his legislative program would not be enacted. And the unpopularity continued. At the end of the period, the Reagan-Bush period, in the regular poll of popularity of living ex-presidents, Reagan ranked right at the bottom, just beat out by Nixon, was a little more unpopular.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, leading political dissident. We'll be back with his speech in Washington, D.C. in a minute.
מספקת בעולם לעשות עכשיו שלום בין בני אדם
Shalom Salam by Alona Liarchik and Amal Merkus here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to Professor Noam Chomsky speaking Sunday at the University of District of Columbia in Washington, D.C.
There are a lot of consequences of the imperial grand strategy, and they're well known. One I've mentioned, it's almost certain to lead to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as a deterrent. That was recognized at once. It increases with every additional step. So last week, Congress dropped the ban on research and development of low-yield nuclear weapons. Low-yield means approximately a third of the Hiroshima bomb. That technology is too advanced for others to follow, except maybe for Israel, because it's an offshoot of U.S. power. But other countries aren't going to be able to follow that. However, it was immediately predicted, and plausibly, that that would be an incentive for other nuclear states to expand their own offensive capacities, for example, Pakistan or China, which means it'll spread to India, and there'll be a chain reaction, probably on to the major nuclear power in the Middle East, Asia region. A number of analysts have pointed out, and it's again obvious, that the Bush administration is practically pleading with Iran to initiate or accelerate a nuclear weapons program. That's going to create a self-fulfilling prophecy in order to justify an invasion, or more likely, I think, subversion, because Iran fails the primary condition for a target. It's not defenseless. And that subversion may already be going on. Another consequence is to increase terror as a deterrent and a revenge. And it's a serious threat. No one should joke about it. Well, enhancing serious threats to U.S. security is, in fact, quite rational within the accepted framework of assumptions. Maybe the framework is lunatic, but the choices within it are quite rational. There just are some higher priorities. So establishing the imperial grand strategy of world domination and restructuring domestic society under the control of unaccountable systems of private power, reducing democracy to empty forms, these are really high priorities. And to achieve them, it's worth facing the threat of massive terror and possible nuclear war. It's not the first time in history that such choices have been made by dedicated leaders. Kind of a miracle we've survived this long, but you can understand the rationality of the policies given the framework. There are other problems. One critical one is the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine problem. Continuing turmoil there threatens U.S. control of the world's major energy resources, and something has to be done about that. Well, what's supposed to be done, we read about. We're supposed to stare in awe at the president's vision of a Palestinian state. You've noticed, I'm sure, that there's a journalistic convention by now that whenever you mention George Bush, you have to mention his vision of something or other. The vision is never described. We don't know what it is, but it's noble by definition. In this case, his vision of a Palestinian state, somewhere, you know, some authority, nobody knows, that's a wonderful vision. You have to forget a few facts when you describe his vision of a Palestinian state. Namely, there's been an international consensus for almost 30 years on establishing a Palestinian state in the territories occupied by Israel. It's also supported by two-thirds of the American public now, meaning a two-state settlement on the international border pre-June 67 with some mutual adjustments. A one-to-one land swap or something like that. For almost 30 years, that's been blocked unilaterally by the United States. I won't run through it, but it continues right through the Clinton-Barack years. So during the Clinton-Barack years, the 1990s, there was a huge program of building settlements and infrastructure with the clear design of splitting the West Bank into four cantons, north, central, south, all separated from East Jerusalem, a little bit of East Jerusalem, the center of Palestinian cultural and commercial life, which is to be virtually separated. And technically, there are some passages, but very hard to maneuver, kind of a four-Bantustan settlement. And that's continuing. The Camp David proposals, year 2000, the Clinton-Barack proposals, they were lauded profusely in the press, magnanimous, wonderful, and so on. There's a very easy way to evaluate the praise. namely, have a look at the map that was proposed. Well, that's a little difficult. Apparently not a single map was published anywhere in the US press, at least nobody can find one. It's not that the maps were unavailable. They were published in Israel, they were published in Europe, they were published in the standard scholarly sources and the dissident literature, but no map was available for people to determine the magnanimity of the offer, and there's a plausible reason for that. As soon as you looked at the map, you saw exactly what I described. Four cantons makes South Africa's Bantustan programs 40 years ago look pretty good. And Sharon and Bush in the next phase are just extending that. While the vision is being pronounced, the bulldozers are happily at work as well. They're creating the facts on the ground, which will tell you what the vision is. There's a separation wall being built from the north. It's already surrounded and virtually destroyed the Palestinian town of Qalqilya. It was announced a couple of weeks ago that south of that it's going to extend to the east, including Ariel and Emmanuel, two settlements to the east. That establishes within the separation wall, meaning on the Israeli side, one of the two Clinton-Barak salients, which were to split the West Bank in three, establishes the northern of the two salients. Nobody doubts that the bigger and more important salient from Jerusalem way over to the east, almost to Jericho, will also be included. That includes the town of Ma'al Adumim, which was built primarily under Clinton and Barak in order to bisect the partition of the West Bank. The territories that are assigned to the settlement go far beyond the actual settled parts, allowing for expansion without any change in, you know, the settlement boundaries. Estimates by Israeli analysts are that includes approximately 50% of the West Bank. And Sharon understands it perfectly well. A lot of talk about how he made this diplomatic move of accepting the roadmap, but less talk about what he told his cabinet. He told them, don't worry about it, about settlement. He said, there is no restriction here, and you can build for your children and grandchildren, and I hope for your great-grandchildren as well. Yeah, and that's very reasonable, given the way the facts on the ground are being established. Quite apart from the vision and the facts on the ground, there's also a record of actions which you can look at. So the Bush administration's first major act with regard to Israel-Palestine at the United Nations in 2001, December, was to veto the dispatch of international monitors to in an effort to reduce the level of violence in the territories. They want the violence to continue because they know it's mostly Israeli violence to suppress the Palestinians. Just a week before that, the Bush administration boycotted and therefore undermined a meeting of the high contracting parties of the Geneva Convention. That's just about everybody, including the whole European Union, which once again produced a harsh condemnation of illegal actions, including just about everything that's going on there, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. All of this, incidentally, is silence. Don't read anything about it. In December, last December, at the next meeting of the UN, the US took a position which, if it's taken seriously, is extremely significant. Every year, the United Nations has ratified a 1968 Security Council resolution calling on Israel to terminate it and withdraw from its effective annexation of East of Jerusalem, expansion and annexation of Jerusalem. This year, last December, for the first time, the United States voted against that. To be precise, it voted against a resolution reaffirming it, meaning voted essentially in favor of the annexation. If that's meant seriously, that's extremely significant. It ends any possibility of any settlement. Jerusalem is now a big area extending into the West Bank. There are two major areas of the world which could go their own way. These are longstanding. One of them, Europe, is a longstanding problem. 30 years ago, was the what was called the Year of Europe, and Henry Kissinger then made a famous address called the Year of Europe Address, in which he instructed the Europeans that they have what he called regional responsibilities, which they are to carry out within the overall framework of order managed by the United States. But don't forget your limits. A lot of the manufactured hatred about France and Germany has to do with they are the heartland of the European economy and of its political strength, and therefore the threat that they might move towards some kind of independent course remains very significant. By now there are similar problems in Asia. Northeast Asia is the most dynamic economic region in the world, the fastest growing. Its gross domestic product is considerably larger than the United States. It has a half of the financial reserves of the world. It's an integrated region. It has resources, developing industrial countries, leading ones that need the resources. Integrated pipelines going from, say, Siberia to South Korea, quote a recent U.S. study, pipelines could enhance regional stability and provide cheap alternatives to oil imported from the Middle East, where the United States maintains control. That's quite significant. One of the major reasons to control the Middle East oil reserves has been to maintain what George Kennan 50 years ago called veto power over other countries. If they forget that they have only regional responsibilities, we can strangle them. But if the integrated region of Northeast Asia actually moves towards independence as it could, that could be that veto power could be lost. The North Korean issue is very much entangled in this. Well, without going on, there are plenty of ominous developments in world affairs. The United States, of course, plays a leading role. It is far and away the most important military power and a huge economy. And for us, that's a very lucky thing. In much of the world, people can't really do very much. In large parts of the world, they live under such repression that they can mostly watch and fear. But we are uniquely privileged, and we can determine the course of future events very substantially. It's not necessary to say that the stakes are very high. It's no exaggeration to say that by this point they literally reach to survival of the species. Thanks.
Professor Noam Chomsky speaking at the University of District of Columbia Gymnasium yesterday in Washington, D.C. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. To listen to other interviews and speeches of Noam Chomsky, you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. And our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Ribel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
All things and what they used to be oil wasted on the oceans.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I'm Bill McCluskey. I'm representing the Society of Professional Journalists.
Andy Schwartzman, Media Access Project.
I'm John Nichols from Free Press.
Michael Bracey, Future Music Coalition.
Ann Chadovitz, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
Mona Mangan, the Writers Guild of America East. Jim Winston, National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters.
Organizations around the country against the further consolidation of the media speak out as the Federal Communications Commission today votes on decades-old rules governing media centralization. It'll unleash the largest wave of media consolidation in U.S. history. But first, we will go to Bog McChesney, author of Our Media, Not Theirs, and hopefully live to the vote. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Eric Rudolph was arrested on Saturday after one of the largest manhunts in U.S. history. Rudolph is charged with attacks on two women's health clinics. One of those attacks killed a police officer and critically wounded a nurse. He's also charged with the bombing of the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta that killed two people and injured over 100, and attacks on a gay nightclub with a nail-packed explosive device. Rudolph spent part of his youth living with the Army of God and with Christian Identity, a white supremacist cult that is anti-gay, anti-Semitic, and anti-foreigner. For years, the survivalist and Army veteran hid deep in the forests of Appalachia from police, equipped with bloodhounds, infrared-equipped helicopters, and motion detectors. He received support, it is believed, from local members of the community. They sold T-shirts saying, "Run, Rudolph, run," and slipped pictures of dead fetuses on the cars of FBI and media joining the chase. Eric Rudolph was arrested on Saturday behind a grocery store in Murphy, North Carolina, by a rookie police officer. Attorney General John Ashcroft said, quote, "The most notorious American fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list has been captured and will face American justice." He added, "The American people, most importantly, the victims of these terrorist attacks, can rest easier." And this news from Zimbabwe. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai was arrested today, the first day in a week of protests and strikes called by Tsvangirai's party, the Movement for Democratic Change. The MDC calls this week's protests the final push in the attempt to drive Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe from power. The capital city of Harare is almost entirely shut down by a massive strike. Police fired tear gas to disperse protesters. Tanks have moved into Harare's townships. The High Court handed the government a victory over the weekend, ruling the protests illegal. State television proclaimed the protests and strikes will be met with the full wrath of the law. The Burmese government arrested opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi on Friday, as well as 19 officials from her party, the National League for Democracy. The government also locked down her headquarters, other party offices around the country, and closed universities in an attempt to prevent students from protesting. The actions come after her supporters and a pro-government group fought in the north of the country. Four people were killed. Some media reports say the Burmese military opened fire on her car. The Burmese military denies this. Australia, Britain, France, and Sweden have demanded Aung San Suu Kyi be released immediately. Secretary of State General Colin Powell was so disturbed by questionable intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction that he assembled a secret team to review the information he was given before he made a crucial speech to the UN Security Council on February 5th. This according to the current issue of the U.S. News and World Report. According to the news magazine, Powell's team removed dozens of pages of alleged evidence that Iraq's banned weapons and ties to terrorists from a draft of his speech. At one point, he became so angry at the lack of adequate sourcing to intelligence claims that he swore, "I'm not reading this. This is bull." On Friday, the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, was forced to issue a statement denying the agency had doctored intelligence reports. U.S. occupation forces in Iraq have abandoned plans to hold a national congress to select an interim government. Instead, the U.S. will appoint a council of some 30 senior figures who will shadow the U.S. administration to prepare for taking power. Meanwhile, U.S. forces have dropped their attempt to cleanse Iraq of assault rifles. Citizens will now be allowed to keep their AK-47s. The U.S. issued no explanation for the change. According to the Telegraph, residents were invited either to register their weapons or to hand over to the police the thousands of machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades that have flooded the city's streets since the war ended. But police stations across the city report not a single weapon has been handed over in the first day of the amnesty. And this news from Evian, France. Tens of thousands of people protested over the weekend against the Group of Eight industrial nations. But authorities have completely cordoned off the small spa resort town from protesters with a 10-mile ring of steel backed by 25,000 police and troops. Yesterday, over 75,000 people marched peacefully to the French-Swiss border. Protesters said rich nations are plundering the economies of the developing world, and that leaders from the global south will come away with nothing but promises. They also protested the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Police severely injured a 39-year-old British protester, Martin Shaw, when they cut the rope he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. Shaw dropped 60 feet from the highway bridge and suffered multiple fractures. British news photographer Dan Smallman of Images Sans Frontières, Images Without Borders, also suffered serious muscle damage to his leg after a stun grenade exploded near him. He underwent 2 hours of surgery and will have to undergo skin grafts. Protesters blocked traffic by erecting barricades on bridges in Geneva and highways in both France and Switzerland. But according to the Associated Press, most of the leaders landed at Geneva Airport and traveled to Evian by helicopter. The AP reports tension flared when the demonstrators tried to return to Geneva and were confronted by rows of riot police. Police fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon, and German police were brought in to help. They led mounted baton charges on protesters. A small group of protesters threw Molotov cocktails and stones at police. Police also raided the building some protesters were using as their headquarters. Independent media journalists report police were dressed in anarchist black bloc gear. The AP reports protesters looted gas stations and shops and smashed bulletproof windows of large banks. The organizers of the Evian protests were quick to distance themselves from the violence. Dozens of people have been arrested. Meanwhile, on the other side of the steel fence, President Bush and French President Jacques Chirac met today for the first time since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Bush is trying to win French support for an action plan on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. The London Guardian reports Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are desperate for a convincing show of unity after their diplomatic fallout with France, Russia, and Germany over Iraq. But President Chirac is resisting Washington's call for sweeping powers to allow ships to be intercepted on suspicion that they're carrying weapons for terrorists. And G8 leaders reiterated a commitment today to restarting world trade talks. Don Henley, Dirty Laundry, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the FCC votes on decades-old rules governing ownership of newspapers, TV, and radio stations. Analysts say the vote to scrap the rules will unleash the largest wave of media consolidation in U.S. history. The rules limit the number of TV stations a company can own. They prevent big networks from merging, and they prohibit companies from owning newspapers and broadcast stations in the same market. Driving the review is FCC Chair Michael Powell, son of Secretary of State General Colin Powell. Powell strongly supported the AOL-Time Warner merger. After the merger, his father's stock options in the company skyrocketed from $6 million to nearly $10 million. Powell is supported by the two other Republicans on the commission. The two Democratic commissioners are opposed. The FCC is therefore expected to pass the rule revisions by a majority of one. Major media conglomerates have been lobbying hard in favor of the new rules. Corporations pressuring the FCC include AOL Time Warner, which in addition to AOL and Time Magazine, owns HBO, CNN, and dozens of magazines. General Electric, Disney, and Viacom also lobbying, which own NBC, ABC, and CBS. And Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, which owns Fox News and many other outlets. But FCC Chair Michael Powell has been reluctant to hear opinions from the public. When Democratic Commissioner Michael Copps called on the FCC to conduct public hearings on the issue, Powell refused. Copps went on to hold several public hearings on his own. Powell boycotted all but one, which he decided to attend only at the last minute as public pressure intensified and he was raked over the coals by the Senate Commerce Committee. It was only then that he headed to Columbia Law School to participate in just one of those forums. The FCC convened its only official hearing with very little notice in Richmond, Virginia in February. We're joined on the telephone now by someone who testified at least one of those hearings, Robert McChesney. He's author of 8 books on media and politics, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy. His latest book is called Our Media, Not Theirs. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob McChesney.
It's a pleasure to be here, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. We are hoping to go live to the hearing during this program. But can you lay out for us what you see at this point? What is at stake?
Well, I think you laid it out well in your introduction. There are a handful of rules that are going to be relaxed today, almost certainly by a 3-2 vote. And these rules will make it much easier for one company to own lots of the media in towns around the country. And that's where the immediate effect will be seen. What has happened with radio, starting in 1996, where a company like Clear Channel could own up to 8 stations in a single community, well, that model is being extended to newspapers and television. So a company like Clear Channel can now also buy the daily newspaper and buy 2 and maybe even 3 television stations in the same community. That's the immediate effect this will have that people will see in communities across the country. And at the national level, big companies that couldn't merge in the past because they owned newspapers and television stations in the same market, like, for example, in New York City, AOL Time Warner couldn't merge with any of the other big media companies, the New York Times, because it owned the cable system and the other companies owned newspapers or TV stations. We're now going to enter an era in which those huge companies can consider getting together because they no longer have prohibitions in owning those sorts of properties in the same community.
We're talking to Bob McChesney, author of Our Media, Not Theirs. Can you talk about, well, one of the things that I read in this lead, driving the review, Michael Powell, son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, General Powell, strongly supported the AOL, well, Michael Powell, the son, supported AOL Time Warner merger. After the merger, his father's stock options in the company skyrocketed from $6 to $10 million. Isn't there a slight conflict of interest here?
Yeah, the whole thing reeks of conflict of interest. I mean, it's almost to begin the catalog of corruption here. It would take us, you'd have to do a 24-hour marathon. I mean, if you go to the website mediareform.net, where we've brought together all the sort of reports on this, the FCC you know, in the last 6 months since Powell's announced he would do this regulatory review of the media ownership rules, has had 71 closed-door meetings without records being taken, FCC members and top staffers with corporate lobbyists. It's only held five such meetings with any other groups in society. I mean, it's basically the entire process reeks of corruption. The Michael Powell and all the top officials of the FCC have been the recipients of something like 2,500 paid junkets by the industry over the past 5 years or so, whereas, you know, they've gotten no paid junkets from consumer groups or citizens groups. I mean, it's the entire process reeks of corruption. Here you have, as you pointed out in your introduction, Michael Powell has refused to have any public input into this rules review, and he's done this for a very obvious reason. He wants to ram these rules through to pay back these powerful lobbyists, and the public has spoken almost unanimously that they don't like the idea of having fewer media owners. I mean, it's probably no issue that so unites Americans across the political spectrum is the idea that it's not a healthy thing to have fewer companies own more and more media. So Michael Powell knows, to the extent the public is allowed to participate at all, it's going to put a kibosh on his plans to basically hand over the keys to the store to these handful of super powerful lobbyists.
Bob McChesney, what about what happens after today?
Well, what happens is there's at two levels or three levels. The immediate effect will be that firms are going to implement plans to make a number of buys. They've been lining up now for 6 months, anticipating this day very excitedly. The idea they can start now assemble even larger empires and especially get local monopolies. I mean, as I said, that's the immediate effect here, is to go into a town and be able to buy up most local media and dominate viewers, listeners, and readers on one hand and advertisers on the other hand. But, I mean, the political fight's just starting. And I think what's striking about this episode, and the fact that I think Pacifica, Amy, and that your show's covering this, is just an indication that the idea that media policy, media ownership, the way our media is structured, is becoming a really important political issue in this country. People increasingly recognize it. And what's taken place in the last 6 months is we've seen the rise of a movement. And this movement's just beginning. You know, we've had membership-driven groups like Move On and Common Cause that have made this their number one issue to work on. And it's not because some top-down leader said, hey, we should work on this. It's because the membership saying, hey, we are tired of propaganda news coverage on this war. We're tired of garbage local journalism. And I think we're going to see the political activism on the issues of media policy, media ownership, continue to grow and take off. And we're going to see organizing, we're going to see demonstrations, we're going to see legislation to have people organize to sort of take back the media system or just take it, not even referring to an older era, and have media ownership rules that basically have more diverse ownership and a much stronger place for nonprofit and non-commercial media.
We're talking to Bob McChesney. Do you see connections between General Colin Powell, Secretary of State, leading the war on Iraq, and his son leading the war against diversity of voices in the media? Because the media is perhaps the most powerful tool of the Pentagon right now.
No, in fact, I'm glad you raised this. It hasn't been talked about enough, because during the Iraq war, when we were getting coverage and have been getting coverage from our conventional news media, our mainstream news media, especially, though not exclusively, our broadcast media that Michael Powell deals with directly, the coverage was, you know, basically spoon-feeding us government propaganda, stories about weapons of mass destruction and Jessica Lynch. They were absolutely preposterous. It was a caliber of journalism befitting a banana republic or an authoritarian or totalitarian society. It was truly hideous, is truly hideous. And this is what drove so many Americans to say, we can't allow these companies, basically, the same companies that spoon-feed us government lies, to get bigger and bigger so they can have more control over our journalism. But while this was going on, Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell, the head of the SEC, was so ecstatic about the caliber of coverage of the war. He said, look at the great coverage we're seeing of the war in Iraq. This proves we don't have to worry about media consolidation. I mean, you know, the irony that was there was lost in him, I think.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Bob McChesney, author of Our Media, Not Theirs. We are hoping to go live to the hearing in just a few minutes. But before we do that, after our break, we're going to hear from some of the community activists and organizations that have been organizing over the last months against media consolidation. Stay with us.
Kick 'em when they're up, kick 'em when they're down, kick 'em when they're up, kick 'em all around.
Dirty Laundry, Don Henley, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now back a few days to a news conference that was held in Washington, led by the two dissident FCC commissioners, Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, where dozens of organizations were represented, beginning with Reverend Bob Chase of the United Church of Christ.
The telecommunications industry accounts for one-sixth of our economy. So what's really at stake here is the whole range of employment and hiring issues that accompany these realities. As Terry O'Neill reminded us, the FCC's own data from 2001 show that only 4.3% of stations are women-owned businesses, and less than 3.5% are owned by people of color. This doesn't reflect the reality of our increasingly multicultural society. So for us, it is fundamentally a question of justice. In 1968, the Kerner Commission charged the broadcast industry with special responsibility in our nation's movement toward two societies, separate and unequal, which is why the broadcast industry has been held to a higher standard for diversity, recruitment, and hiring. What we say about ourselves on the airwaves is critical to our well-being as a nation and our understanding of who we are. What people see, hear, and read is inevitably a product, at least in part, of the racial, cultural, and gender identities of those who produce news and information programming on the airwaves. The United Church of Christ, as you've said, has always been concerned about empowering those from historically marginalized communities to be represented fairly in the media. Claims that relaxing ownership caps will enhance diversity are counterintuitive. The whole point of regulatory policy is to do what's best for the people, all the people. We are not saying that marketplace values, which so dominate the debate today, are invalid. Rather, we claim they are insufficient for the public good. And we call upon the FCC to exercise its congressionally mandated authority and set policies based not on economic efficiencies, but on the public interest. And so that would be what we would add.
Okay. Thank you. For Candace Presley, I have a question about you're the president of the National Association of Black Journalists, and your organization's written about the negative impact that changes in these rules would have on content and diversity and competition. Could you explain the position of your organization on these things and the connection between the rules and the quality of journalism that we're going to see in this country?
Absolutely, and I would like to thank both of the commissioners for the opportunity to be here with all of you today. The National Association of Black Journalists is an organization of about 3,000 African-American journalists who work in the nation's newspapers, television stations, radio stations, magazines, and online internet journalism endeavors. We came together in 1975 largely for this reason. There was an opportunity in journalism to cover the civil rights movement, and many of the mainstream news organizations found that in order to cover the story adequately and to do the fair and accurate reporting that needed to be done, they could not send the reporters who were currently working in their newsrooms into these black communities to get the story. So, what happened? The mainstream news organizations went into the black community and into the black press and recruited many African American journalists to come to work in mainstream media in order to go out into our beginning growing diverse community to cover those stories. So, fast forward now to 2003, and we talk about the NABJ and why we exist. We exist largely to promote greater newsroom diversity, to expand job and recruiting opportunities for journalists of color, particularly for African American journalists of color. And we also work very hard to advocate balance and coverage in our community and our experience. These changes in these ownership rules that are coming on the second, we believe will have a resounding negative impact, as you've said, on the quality of news content, the diversity of voices and viewpoints, and indeed competition. This issue of media ownership and consolidation trumps all of the other issues that are key to the mission and success of an organization like the NABJ or the National Association of Hispanic Journalists or the Asian American Journalists Association or even the Native American Journalists Association, because the reason we are so interested in these changes not happening is because there are a finite number of jobs and opportunities that are available in broadcasting, and future media consolidation will only result in a reduction of that finite number of jobs and opportunities for journalists of color to come in and to tell the stories of a growing diverse population. We believe very strongly that there needs to be a diversity of viewpoints, a diversity of voices to tell the stories of the people that we serve. And we implore the FCC, and we thank you so much for fighting this good fight, because it would seem that just as our nation gets more and more brown, the only color that the big media owners are seeing is green. And that is not the right color to see. Thank you.
Speaking of a finite number of jobs, Bernie Lunger represents the Communications Workers of America. CWA has members all across the country who work for local media companies. And I'd just like to ask him what his prediction is for how much programming and news gathering and employment is going to be done for local citizen if we remove or significantly loosen these concentration protections that are currently in place.
Well, we know that the reality of story generation comes down to reporters on the beat. And when you have fewer reporters on fewer beats, you're just going to get a lot less information. You look at the back of this room, take away a third to a half of the journalists that are there, and you get an idea of what we might have in our future. The only way for this thing to work for these fewer owners that we keep talking about is to have fewer workers who are really generating less news that is then distributed across more channels. That's the basic economics of it. So you can figure it out for yourself. And as we just heard, we already have a problem with diversity within that pool of available jobs, and it's just going to get worse. So we're very troubled by it. We think, as Juan Gonzalez pointed out, we need to look past this decision, even if it is going to go the wrong way. In the meanwhile, I'm very happy to be here with a couple of very progressive commissioners and in very good company. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Jim Winston if he wants to respond to that. And Jim Winston's president of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. And also, we've heard from your members, some of whom have said that they've done very well in broadcasting over the years, very proud of how they've done. But they say that in today's world, they don't think, given the level of concentration that now exists, that they could replicate that success. And what do you think further media consolidation would have? What effect would it have on minorities' ability to own media outlets?
Thank you, Commissioner Adelstein, Commissioner Copps. Certainly, the issues have been discussed quite well, specifically by the journalists, by the Hispanic journalists, Black journalist organizations, because it comes down to who's deciding the news, who's going to control the news, who's hiring the news directors, who's hiring the assignment direct editors, who's going to decide what news is covered, what news goes on the air. And as they all pointed out, it all comes down to ownership. The National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters is an owner's organization. We have companies that own approximately 240 radio stations and 20 television stations around the country. Out of 13,000 radio stations and 1,300 television stations around the country, that's a very small number. So we don't pretend to think that we can control the voices that the African-American community hears across the country. Clear Channel touts the fact that they are the largest programmer to the African-American and Hispanic communities across the country. So we recognize the limits of our voices. But the important thing is that we have a voice. And the ability to create new voices for the minority community has been greatly diminished by consolidation. In radio, radio is sort of the guinea pig for deregulation. In 1996, all ownership national caps were taken off of radio, and that's how Clear Channel was able to go from 40 stations to 1,225 in such a brief period of time. What that means is that they have changed the landscape for radio ownership, so that if one looks to become a radio station owner now, to get financed, you've got to buy a cluster of stations. That's the business model for broadcasting today. So for an organization like NABOC, we get calls from minorities saying, I'd like to become a broadcast station owner. How do I go about doing that? Once upon a time, you could buy a small station in your market, become a voice in that community. That's really no longer possible. Now you've got to buy a cluster of stations to demonstrate you can compete against the companies that have clusters of stations in your market. Buying a cluster of stations is obviously a very big financial undertaking, and it means that no longer can you go to a group of friends and maybe your local bank to get finance to become a station owner. Now you've got to go to venture capital companies, small business investment companies, in addition to banks to get financed. So replication of growth in media is very difficult now, and as a result, we're seeing a decrease in minority ownership. Since the Telecom Act of 1996, the number of African-American owners had fallen to 14% by 2001, and since that date, it's probably fallen even further. We just don't have statistics on that number. So replication of the successes of many of my members is no longer possible, and further deregulation will only make those opportunities even fewer. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Patty Miller from Children Now, you've been listening to the presentations today, and several speakers have talked about the impact on children, and I know that your organization recently released a study on the correlation between consolidation and what our kids are seeing on television. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. In order to inform the Commission's rulemaking, Children Now decided to conduct a study. It's the first study ever to look at media consolidation and the impact on children's programming. We looked at Los Angeles, and we looked at Los Angeles in 1998 and in 2003, before and after the creation of duopolies in that market. And what we found was pretty striking. Since media concentration was allowed in Los Angeles, the amount of children's programming available has been cut in half across the board. That's in the number of series available for kids and the number of hours. What's very striking about this is that most of the declines occurred in stations that were part of duopolies, which I think really shows that there is a link between media consolidation and the diversity and availability of programming for children. We also found that there was that the number of children's series that were broadcast on more than one channel almost quadrupled between 1998 and 2003. So when you have series that are airing on stations that are owned by large media conglomerates, they ended up being shown most of the time also on their cable counterparts, signifying a real decline in diversity for kids. We think the message from this study is clear. Large media conglomerates are not acting in the best interests of our nation's kids. And we also think that this study in some ways is the canary in the coal mine, you know, signaling what can happen if, you know, we continue to go down this path and allow for further consolidation. I'd also like to point out this is just one study, and there's so many more studies that need to be done. I mean, we didn't have time, because of how quickly this was all happening, to look at the quality of programming. I mean, what does consolidation mean for the quality of children's programming? And who are the producers providing this programming? That's another question. You know, is there a diversity of producers who are providing this program for our nation's kids? I mean, I think it's really clear that, you know, children are a special audience. They merit special protection, and that the FCC has an obligation to slow down and consider the full extent of consolidation on our nation's kids before proceeding.
It's really these unanswered questions that bother me, I think, most about this proceeding and the unintended consequences.
You've been listening to the press conference earlier this week against media consolidation. We are now turning here on Democracy Now! Live to the FCC meeting that has just been convened by the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Powell. We join him in progress.
Multiple ownership rules. The consideration of this item to be presented by the Media Bureau is your agenda for today.
Thank you. Chief Farig.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. The sun is shining outside. The tour buses are crowding the streets of Washington. It is spring, finally, I think. I was doing some spring cleaning myself a few weekends ago, and I found these in my basement. Which really are a relic in my house, which has been wired to cable since before my children were born. And I've found that children today can't tell the difference between the 100 plus cable channels that are available to them and the broadcast channels. Americans now have more
media. This is FCC spokesperson Faree.
Information and more varied entertainment programming available to them than ever before. A generation ago, only science fiction writers dreamed of satellite-delivered television. Cable was little more than a delivery platform for broadcast signals, and the seeds of the Internet were just being planted in a government project. Today, hundreds of channels of video programming are available in every market in the country, and via the Internet, Americans can access virtually any information, anywhere, anytime, on any topic. Nonetheless, while the march of technology has brought us unprecedented access to information and programming, our broadcast ownership rules continue to reflect a bygone era. The poet James Russell Lowell cautioned us not to attempt the future's portal with the past's blood-rusted key. Our rules are about as rusty as they can be. Many of them have been called into question, reversed, or outright vacated by the court. What remains is a patchwork of unenforceable and indefensible restrictions that, while laudable in principle, utterly fail to serve the interests they purport to serve. The item before you includes proposed rules that will provide a shiny new key for the digital future. These rules will serve our competition, diversity, and localism goals in highly targeted ways, and together they form a comprehensive framework that is responsive to today's media environment. I cannot adequately express my gratitude to the staff of the Industry Analysis Division, in particular to Paul Gallant, in the few moments that I have here, but they have set the standard in my mind for dedication and hard work. And if the chair will indulge me, I would like to take just a moment to identify the 2002 biennial ownership team by name. They are Bob Radcliffe, Manya Baghdadi, Judy Herman, Roger Holberg, Danny Bring, Scott Roberts, Keith Brown, John Scott, Tom Tanasevich, George Williams, Amy Brett, Aaron Dozier, Deborah Saborin, Julie Salavara, Beth Vallinati, Patrick Weber, Jane Frenette, Ann Levine, Tim May, Rita McDonald, and Linda Senecal. We also received terrific support from John Levy and Simon Wilkie in OSPPA, from Tom Spavins in the Enforcement Bureau, and from Marilyn Sohn, Joel Kaufman, Nandan Joshi, and Linda Kinney from the Office of General Counsel. Nandan will present the modified local radio rule. Aaron will present the modified local television rule and our cross-media limits. Patrick will present the national rules, and Beth will kick it off with a presentation of our legal and policy goals section of the item. Beth?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. The report in order before you today brings to fruition the Commission's third biennial ownership review, the most comprehensive review yet, addressing all six broadcast ownership rules. It is the culmination of a 20-month period in which the Commission sought, reviewed, and analyzed one of the most extensive public records in its history, encompassing more than 500,000 comments. The media ownership rules under review in this proceeding are the newspaper broadcast and radio television cross-ownership rules, the local television and local radio ownership rules, the national television ownership rule, and the dual network rule. Today's report and order replaces the newspaper broadcast and radio television cross-ownership rules with a set of cross-media limits, modifies the local television multiple ownership rule, modifies the local radio ownership rule and its market definition, modifies the national television ownership rule, and retains the dual network rule. In sum, the modified ownership structure provides a new, comprehensive, national and local regulatory framework that will serve the Commission's policy goals of promoting competition, diversity, and localism. This biennial regulatory review was performed pursuant to Section 202H of the Communications Act of 1996, which requires that the Commission's rules be reviewed every 2 years to determine whether they are necessary in the public interest as the result of competition. The report and order concludes, based on the D.C. Circuit Court's decisions in the Fox Television and Sinclair cases, that the rational basis standard is the correct First Amendment standard to apply to the broadcast ownership rules. The report and order identifies competition, diversity, and localism as longstanding policy goals that continue to be core agency objectives in regulating media ownership. The report and order promotes competition by ensuring pro-competitive market structures so that the benefits of competition, including lower prices, innovation, and improved service, are made available to the public. It affirms the Commission's core value of limiting broadcast ownership to promote viewpoint diversity, stating that the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the public. Thus, the report and order adheres to the Commission's longstanding determination that a limit on common ownership of multiple media outlets is the most reliable means of promoting viewpoint diversity. Further, the report and order reaffirms the Commission's goal of promoting localism through broadcast ownership limits that are aligned with stations' incentives to serve the needs and interests of their communities. The report and order also reaffirms the Commission's long-standing objective of encouraging greater ownership of broadcast facilities by minorities and women. It creates greater opportunities for new entrants in the broadcasting industry by carving out special transactional opportunities for small businesses, many of which are owned by minorities and women. The report and order finds that today's media marketplace is marked by abundance and that consumers have more and better access to information than at any time in history. Since 1960,
Elizabeth Valenotti is a member of the FCC staff with the County Policy Division.
The report and order analyzes selected markets and finds that the amount of local broadcast television news has doubled and that national television news programming has increased even more dramatically. In 1960, national television news was generally limited to 5 to 15 minutes per day, whereas today, choices for national news abound, with the advent of numerous 24-hour cable news services. Roughly 80 million homes now subscribe to either cable television or direct broadcast satellite services. Non-broadcast programming has continued to proliferate, with more than 300 satellite-delivered programming services available. New modes of communication, most notably the internet, have further transformed the landscape, placing into the hands of citizens more choice and more control than at any time in history. Aaron Dozier will now discuss the cross-ownership rules and the local television multiple ownership rule.
The report and order finds that the current newspaper broadcast and radio television cross-ownership rules are not necessary in the public interest. The report and order concludes that because newspapers and broadcast stations are not substitutes from a competition standpoint, common ownership of these outlets will not present competitive harms. The report and order further finds that common ownership of a newspaper and a broadcast station in the same market can create certain efficiencies that will benefit the public interest by enhancing the common owner's ability to provide local news and information. The report and order also eliminates the radio television cross-ownership rule. The report and order finds that radio and television do not compete in the same economic markets, and that where they are considered substitutes, other media outlets will remain available as a result of the modified local television and local radio ownership rules. Moreover, the record does not demonstrate that the rule is necessary to promote broadcasters' provision of local news and information programming or to ensure viewpoint diversity. In lieu of the overly restrictive newspaper broadcast and radio television cross-ownership rules, the report and order establishes a set of cross-media limits which will better effectuate the Commission's competition, diversity, and localism goals. These limits were developed in part through the use of a diversity index, which analyzes and measures the availability of outlets that contribute to viewpoint diversity. The index is consumer-centric in that it is based on how Americans use different outlets for news and information. The cross-media limits vary according to the size of a market. In markets with 9 or more television stations, cross-ownership of media is permitted without limits. The record demonstrates that the local television and local radio limits will be sufficient to ensure competition, diversity, and localism in these markets. In markets with 4 to 8 television stations, the cross-media limits would permit ownership of a combination that includes radio, television, and newspaper properties under certain circumstances. Specifically, an entity could own a daily newspaper, a single television station, and multiple radio stations, as long as the number of radio stations does not exceed 50% of the local radio cap for that market. In addition, the owner of a daily newspaper, which does not also own a local television station, could own as many radio stations as permitted by the local radio ownership rule. The cross-media limits do not permit common ownership of a newspaper and more than one television station in markets of this size. Finally, the cross-media limits prohibit any cross-ownership of media outlets in markets with three or fewer television stations. With respect to the local television ownership rule, the report and order finds that in light of the myriad sources of competition to local television broadcast stations, the current rule is not necessary in the public interest to foster competition. Through a competitive analysis, the report and order determines that same market combinations yield efficiencies which will serve the public interest by improving or expanding services such as local news and public affairs programming and facilitating the transition to digital television. The report and order also finds that the current rule is not necessary to promote localism and that, to the contrary, by prohibiting many same market combinations that may yield public interest benefits, the rule may in fact hinder achievement of that goal. The report and order concludes, however, that competitive harms would occur with the elimination of all local television ownership restrictions. The report and order therefore modifies the local television ownership rule to permit an entity to own as many as two television stations in markets with 17 or fewer full-power television stations, and up to three stations in markets with 18 or more stations. The report and order also prohibits same market combinations involving stations ranked among the top four in terms of audience share. Because there is a significant separation in the audience shares of top four ranked stations as compared to other stations in local markets, the report and order concludes that combinations involving top four ranked stations would result in competitive harms. Further, such combinations are less likely to produce offsetting public interest benefits, as the top four ranked stations are more likely to already offer local news and public affairs programming and to have made the transition to digital television. The report and order eliminates the provision of the current rule that permits combinations of two television stations that do not have overlapping signal contours. Because of mandatory carriage of television broadcast stations by multi-channel video programming distributors, the geographic market in which a station competes is generally its Nielsen-designated market area rather than its over-the-air service area. Therefore, all proposed station combinations will be subject to the restrictions described above without regard to contour overlap. The report and order modifies the standards for rule waiver requests involving failed, failing, and unbuilt stations by removing the requirement to demonstrate that there is no reasonably available out-of-market buyer. It also provides guidelines for waiver of the top four ranked restriction in markets of certain sizes and addresses existing combinations that may not comply with the modified local television ownership rule. Although the report and order recognizes that television broadcast stations compete with other providers of delivered video programming, it finds that because those competitors offer national programming, they are unlikely to respond to changes in local market concentration. Since competition in local markets is more likely to be affected by the competitive responses of local television broadcast stations, the modified rule focuses on ownership of these stations. Further, because viewpoint diversity is fostered when there are multiple television outlets, the competition-based local television rule will advance the Commission's goal of promoting viewpoint diversity. Nandan Joshi will now discuss the local radio ownership rule.
The report and order before you today completes a comprehensive examination of the state of competition in the radio broadcasting industry. An examination that began.
You're listening to Democracy Now, broadcasting live the FCC hearing on consolidation.
Rulemaking dockets. The report and order concludes that radio broadcast stations operate in product markets that do not include other media, such as newspapers and television stations. As a result, the report and order finds that the competitive harms associated with undue concentration of radio stations in a local community cannot be ameliorated by the presence of other media. With respect to the geographic market in which radio stations operate, the report and order concludes that the current method used to define radio markets is not in the public interest and must be modified. The report and order finds that the current method, which relies on the signal contours of commonly owned stations, is unsound and produces anomalous and irrational results that undermine the purpose of the rule.
The report and order rejects arguments that the Commission lacks the statutory authority to alter the market definition methodology and concludes that a market definition that is based on geography as opposed to signal contours provides a more rational means for protecting competition in local radio markets. The report and order adopts the Arbitron Metro definition as the relevant radio market for those areas of the country in which metros are defined. Radio stations will be assigned to individual metros based on the location of their communities of license. If a station is considered home to an Arbitron Metro, it will be assigned to that market as well. For areas not covered by Arbitron Metros, the item initiates a new proceeding to define local radio markets for purposes of applying the local radio ownership rule. In the interim, the item establishes a modified contour overlap methodology that will apply to stations located outside of Arbitron Metros pending completion of this rulemaking proceeding. After discussing the proper product and geographic markets for radio, the report and order concludes that the existing numerical limits on radio station ownership are necessary in the public interest. Limits on radio station ownership protect competition in local radio markets. Competitive markets in turn benefit radio listeners by ensuring that radio stations face competitive pressure to broadcast quality programming that is responsive to the needs and interests of their local communities. The report and order finds, however, that the current rule improperly fails to consider the influence that non-commercial radio stations have on competition in local radio markets. The report and order therefore modifies the local radio ownership rule to count non-commercial radio stations in the local radio market. The report and order also examines joint sales agreements, or JSAs, which give a party the right to broker or sell the advertising time of a radio station. The report and order concludes that a radio station operating under a JSA will be counted against the broker's local radio ownership limit under certain conditions. The report and order also addresses issues relating to grandfathering of existing combinations that may not comply with the modified local radio, television, or cross-media limits. The report and order grandfathers existing holdings. Transfers of grandfathered interests must comply with the local rules proposed in this item. Unless such transfers are made to an eligible small business as defined in the report and order. The report and order also establishes a transition policy to deal with applications filed before the modified rules become effective. Patrick Weber will now discuss the national ownership rules.
The report and order concludes that the current national television ownership rule, which prohibits any entity from owning television stations that in the aggregate reach more than 35% of the country's television households, is not necessary in the public interest. Consistent with the 1984 multiple ownership order, the report and order concludes that restricting national station ownership does not promote competition or diversity. The report and order also confirms the Commission's finding in the 1998 biennial report that preserving a balance of power between the networks and their affiliated stations serves localism because affiliates play an important counterbalancing role to the networks. The report and order finds that a national television ownership limit is necessary to promote localism by preserving the power of affiliates to negotiate with their networks, to influence network provided programming, and to individually select, via rights of preemption, programming responsive to the needs and tastes of their local communities. The record shows, however, that the cap at the current level is not necessary to preserve the balance of bargaining power between networks and their affiliates. The record also indicates that the current cap appears to have drawbacks, such as restraining some of the largest group owners from serving additional communities with greater quantity and quality of local news and public affairs programming. Balancing these competing interests, the report and order applies a limit of 45% audience reach to television station owners. The report and order finds that raising the cap to 45% would help networks compete more effectively with cable and DBS operators and would promote free over-the-air television by deterring the migration of expensive programming to cable networks. The report and order also retains the 50% UHF discount when calculating a television station owner's national reach. The UHF discount recognizes the deficiencies in over-the-air UHF reception as compared to VHF reception. The report and order finds that more than 40 million Americans only have access to free over-the-air television. The record shows that UHF television stations have smaller signal coverage areas than VHF stations, impacting their ability to compete. The record also shows that UHF stations have substantially lower ratings than VHF stations. Moreover, The record shows that the UHF discount has promoted the entry of new broadcast networks into the market. These new networks have improved consumer choice and program diversity for all Americans, including those with cable and DBS services. The digital transition will largely eliminate the technical basis for the UHF discount, because UHF and VHF signals will be substantially equalized. Therefore, the report and order provides for a sunset of the UHF discount for the stations owned by the four largest broadcast networks as the digital transition is completed on a market-by-market basis. This sunset will apply unless, prior to that time, the Commission determines that the public interest would be served by continuation of the discount beyond the digital transition. The report and order further provides that in a subsequent biennial review, the Commission will determine whether to include stations owned by other networks and station group owners in the sunset provision. Finally, the report and order concludes that the dual network rule, which prohibits a merger between or among the top four broadcast networks, ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC, is necessary in the public interest to promote competition and localism. Because the top four broadcast networks are participants in the program acquisition market and the national advertising market, mergers between or among them would affect competition in each of these markets. Given the level of vertical integration in each of the top four broadcast networks, a top four network merger would give rise to competitive concerns that the merged firm would be able to restrict the consumption of programming by using its market power to limit competitors' access to sources of programming. The merged firm could also use its market power to control the price it pays for programming or to raise the costs, a competitor's costs, of acquiring programming. The report and order reaffirms the Commission's finding in the 2001 dual network order that the top four broadcast networks operate as a strategic group within the national television advertising market. A top four network merger would substantially reduce competition within the strategic group for national advertising revenue, which would lead to less varied, lower quality, and less innovative programming.
You've been listening to Patrick Webray, who is the FCC Media Bureau Attorney Advisor, in these historic FCC media consolidation final decision announcement today. We will bring you the rest of it tomorrow on Democracy Now!, so be sure that you tune in. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, with Rich Kim. Our website, democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
A technological dividend is what I strongly recommend to be paid out to everyone, from taxes taken back from the Pentagon.
Transactions that promote the public interest while ensuring that no company can monopolize the medium. I am confident we succeed by today's order. This proceeding has been the subject of extraordinary public attention. To my mind, it is right that it has been so, for the values these rules are intended to advance are critically important to a vibrant democracy. I have heard the concerns expressed by the public about excessive consolidation. Though such generalized worries do not clearly suggest specific answers to the specific issues the Commission must address, they have, introduced a note of caution in the choices we have made. Consequently, our decisions today, retaining the rule against networks merging, tightening the limits on radio ownership, and modifying rather than eliminating the remaining rules, are modest, albeit very significant changes. But I must punctuate one irreducible point. Keeping the rules exactly as they are, as some so stridently suggest, was not a viable option. Without today's surgery, the rules would assuredly meet a swift death. As the only member of this commission here during the last biennial review, I watched firsthand as we bent to political pressure and left many rules unchanged. Nearly all were rejected by the court because of our failure to apply the statute faithfully. I have been committed to not repeating that error, for I believe the stakes are perilously high. Leaving things unaltered, regardless of any change in the competitive landscape, is a course that only Congress can legitimately chart. For these reasons, we have embraced a challenge unparalleled in the FCC's history. We collected a thorough record, analyzed our broadcast ownership rules from the ground up, and wrote rules that matched the times. For the first time, we documented the state of the entire industry, empirically analyzed different transactions and their effect on our diversity goals, and, I think most importantly, sought the views of our citizens as to how they obtain their news and public information in an effort to craft rules consistent with the actual rather than theoretical viewing and listening patterns of Americans. I am confident and proud of the job we have done. I believe that our actions will advance our diversity and localism's goals and maintain a vigorously competitive environment. But before concluding, I would like to express my deep appreciation of my colleagues for their tireless effort over these past many months. Commissioners Adelstein and Copps have organized numerous hearings throughout the nation and deserve credit for bringing unprecedented public input to this proceeding. Commissioners Abernathy and Martin have been actively engaged in every step of the process and contributed enormously to the order that's before us today. I admire the genuine commitment of all four of my colleagues to serving the American public in this proceeding. And finally, they are simply not enough words of commendation for the spectacular efforts of the men and women of the Media Bureau. Their dedication and commitment are in the finest traditions of public service. And to them, I and the American people are forever grateful. Other commissioners, comments or questions, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, the Commission faces, once again, a historic decision affecting free speech, where it must decide whether to be guided by facts or by fears. For literally years, this Commission has struggled in a highly politicized environment through Democratic and Republican administrations to strike an appropriate balance in its media ownership rules. Many have argued that this proceeding is about the core of our democracy, and I agree. And nothing is more fundamental to democracy than following the rule of law as given to us by Congress and as interpreted by the courts. Our success will ultimately be judged not by a public relations assessment, but by the rigorous demands of judicial review. It is a heavy responsibility, and I believe we have exercised it well. I began my review of the FCC's media ownership rules with three inescapable realities: the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the judicial decisions interpreting it, and the U.S. Constitution. First, the Act requires the Commission to conduct a review every 2 years to determine which of our broadcast ownership rules can be justified in the modern world of media. For those who want us to delay this proceeding, I cannot do it. In fact, we are already 5 months behind schedule and therefore unfaithful to congressional intent. Second, judicial decisions in this area have been struck down. Every broadcast ownership rule that the courts have reviewed has been struck down since the passage of the 1996 Act. Each time, the courts found the FCC had failed to justify the limits that it continued to place on broadcast ownership. So for those who want the Commission to maintain all the rules in their current form, you're asking me to defy the federal courts. This I will not do, nor should you want me to. Third, the First Amendment to the Constitution